You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Welcome back, everybody. Or welcome, I guess, because we're back after a week. This is the Rational Revolution. You've got Mark Becker here.
I am your host.
If you missed it last week, we had RNC chairman, former RNC chairman, Michael Steele, and he talked. What a discussion that guy can give. It's available on civicmedia.us, wherever you get your podcasts. Can we just talk about the run of guests we've had here on this show? You know, because since last month, we've got Adam Kinzinger, Jeff Cabaservis, Officer Harry Dunn from the January 6th committee, Ben Wickler, and now we've got a whopper for you. We've got my new friend and your new friend, Christina Dry, who is the speechwriter and communications analyst for USAID. AID? USAID? Is that the correct way to do it?
Well, people in the building say USAID, and then Okay. Everyone else has been saying USAID, so you can't be wrong.
Okay, well, I want to be respectful at least, and do it the right way. So USAID would be.
Yeah, let's do USAID.
All right, deal. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming.
Okay. Of course, thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to see you. But I have to say, first off, to you, your colleagues, and really everybody in the federal government, I'm so sorry. What has happened? What an awful thing done by awful people, and none of you deserved that at all. And so, I did want to recognize that.
Thank you. That means a lot.
Yeah. So I guess to start, I wanted to give people a little bit of a long bit of a background because I think this matters. So there are so many people that had no idea what USAID was.
Right.
Before all of this happened. Can you talk about what is the mission of USAID? What do you guys do? All of that stuff.
Yeah. So USAID was founded in 1961 by John F. Kennedy, and it was meant to be a very powerful wing of the U.S., government and national security apparatus. So when we think of national security, we think of what we call the three Ds, and that would be defense, which is Pentagon, diplomacy, which is the State Department, and then development, which has become USAID. And it's gone through many iterations over the decades as the field of development itself has, developed. But what we really do is bring aid to people around the world from the American people. And that can look like everything from, providing public health care to, HIV, AIDS positive people in around the world. It can look like providing humanitarian assistance after earthquakes or tsunamis or other forms of devastation. It can look like providing, water sanitation services, especially to places where that is a public health need. And it can look like bringing, which, especially as of yesterday is no longer happening, but bringing aid to places like Ukraine, where we worked with, the Ukrainian people in Europe on the Black Sea Grain Deal Initiative to help, supply chains for grain around the world, where we worked to electrify so that Putin couldn't weaponize winter. So there are many ways that it's kindness, it's the best of the American people, and it's generosity, but it's also helping us directly here at home. And both of those things together are what USAID is meant to do. It's what development can do for, both parties. You feed two birds with one scone, as I like to say.
So I like that. That's good. Feed two birds with one scone. I like that. Yeah. What? This was widely embraced by both parties.
Yeah, it is. It's historically embraced by both parties. You have, throughout administrations, for example, PEPFAR, which is one of our most successful programs. It saved the lives of, I think the number is 24 million people around the world. And that was, instituted under George W. Bush's reign or administration. And then you have, so many senators that are traditionally very conservative that support this work. I think, Tom Tillis from North Carolina, which is my home, Senator Graham from South Carolina. You have so many people that have supported this work widely because it also supports, Americans here at home. We source $2 billion in agricultural food aid from American farmers every single year. We invest $1 billion or invested $1 billion in American small businesses. So everyone up until this moment has seen it as a value add. And then all of a sudden, you know, those tides have turned in a very surprising way.
Yeah. And as we're talking to Christina Dry, speechwriter and communications analyst for USAID, that's one of the things too that I think we don't necessarily know how it's going to hurt us here in Wisconsin, because I mean, we're a huge agriculture state. Talk about, you know, what did USAID purchase from farmers all across America?
Yeah. So everything from, you know, lentils and sweet potatoes to peanuts to wheat. So any food aid that, you know, we would give to people around the world was really sourced from American farmers. I don't know the statistics off the top of my head for Wisconsin specifically, which I know is a massive agricultural state, but a great example would be peanuts from Georgia. And the peanuts go into, it's called RUTF, which is ready to use therapeutic food. And it's like a magical peanut paste is the best way to describe it. It's one of the only things that can bring a child that is acutely, you know, malnourished back from the brink of death. And it's peanuts, it's milk, and it's a lot of vitamins and tons of calories in this very small packet that, you know, shelf stable, able to be distributed. And all of those peanuts are sourced from American farmers. I know, you know, any kind of food that we provide, and that's $2 billion. And then you have the associated, you know, economic, you know, downfall from that. So then the farmers are able to purchase from their own, you know, community. So another great example, and again, with the North Carolina Connect, three or four of USAID's top development partners were in North Carolina, which is an estimated, I think, $36 billion to the economy. And that's just one state. And so then you go state by state by state for the economic support. And it really is a hit to the American people just as much as it's a hit to people around the world, in the sense that you're losing kind of this like vital lifeline.
So you talk about a hit to the American people. When someone, and I'm sure, I would imagine in that work, you've answered this question a time or two, but when someone says, you know, we have need in our country, why do these programs matter? Why can't we spend here?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And I think that I have, you know, gotten that a few times. And my initial answer is it doesn't have to be, you know, a zero sum game. It's not like either we, you know, serve the American people or we serve people abroad. There is this sense and this truth that when we serve people abroad, we're serving the American people. And I can give a few examples of that.
Please. Yeah, absolutely.
In just a second. So for that, I mean, when we invest in, you know, anti-malaria or health abroad, then we're investing in our own health here. When we're doing Ebola screening in Uganda, we're stopping the spread from getting here. And we know how devastating a pandemic is. We've all lived through it. Another great example is when we do democracy building, you know, in Central America, we make those countries more stable, or we help them to make their own countries more stable. And then we stop, or at least halt the spread of, you know, migrants to our borders. When we, you know, work on investing in democracy in Eastern Europe, we do the same thing. So there are so many ways that the work that USAID did directly helps the American people for less than 1% of the federal budget. The second thing with that is that when we're looking, you know, like someone might say, why don't we have a USAID for America? You know, our own kids need education. We need to be able to afford food. We need the economic support for our farmers too. And the answer to that is we do have those resources. You know, we have SNAP benefits. Those were just cut. We have Medicaid, Medicare. Those were just cut. We have an education system that works at both the state and federal level. And the education system is looking at being cut. FEMA, which is our emergency response, you know, system, which, you know, is really help on the ground when people need it most, is also being cut. And that's the same work that USAID does, but it's meant to be here at home. And those take up much more of the budget than USAID did or does. So I would say that answer is twofold. Number one, we do have the resources available to have those same responses in our own country. And if you, you know, as a voter care about that investment, then you can advocate for that investment. You can, you know, engage with that investment, et cetera. The second thing is that it's not just USAID giving to people around the world because it's the nice thing to do and we'll never see any benefit. We see that benefit every single day. And I think one of the hard things to grasp about that is USAID works on the counterfactual. So it's like, but for USAID, what disease would be in our country? But for USAID, what country would, you know, be less unstable and what would be happening? So you can't see, because the whole point is that we have prevented, it's preventative care. So yeah. Another analogy that's useful, I think, and then I'll, you know, wind down on this question is that, when you go to the doctor, you have two kinds of appointments. You have, you know, preventative care appointments, and then you have reactive care appointments. And it's like, if you fall and break your leg, or, you know, you get sick with a 103 degree fever, you go to the doctor for a reactive appointment. But with the other ones, you go get your yearly checkup for maybe like $5-$15 copay so that they can catch anything and you're going to be healthier. Same thing with the dentist, right? So USAID is very much kind of the preventative care. We identify problems. We identify places that might, you know, be difficult. We address those things so that we don't have to, you know, pay a bigger cost later on for whatever might, you know, happen, right? If there is an Ebola outbreak, if there is a war in a, you know, a certain country or what have you. So it's a twofold thing, and it's not an either or, like money that's going to RUTF for a child in Uganda, therefore is not going into my child's mouth, you know, here in like rural Kentucky or Tennessee.
Yeah. And it's, that's fascinating. And I think, I don't think people really understand the gravity of the loss, you know, it really is something that I think, and I want to talk about this on the other side of the break because we're up against it a little bit, but I want to talk about how, from a national security perspective, it's huge. It's huge. And we're seeing such a gap in leadership right now with the United States. And I do think that it starts with helping our friends and making sure that we can, you know, take the values that we have and we say that are good. We hope so, you know, and then those are just gone. And so I think, you know, when it comes to places like Ukraine and developing countries and all of that, I want to talk about that on the other side. And then I also want to get into kind of like, what are some of the things that you've experienced personally with USAID and how they've helped? Because I'd love to have that story as well. We are talking with Christina Dry here, who worked for USAID as a speechwriter and a communications analyst. I'm Mark Becker. We'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back. You're on The Rational Revolution. We got Mark Becker. You've got our friend Christina Dry, speechwriter, communications analyst for USAID. I got to say thank you to my dear brother, who is now 40. He's old. he turned 40 on the 1st of March. Yes, we're in March. It feels like forever. But anyway, so we were talking about, you know, how USAID fits in the whole, you know, national security diplomacy, that the 3D, the triangle, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about national security and how does that play a part?
Yeah. So with national security, it's all about, you know, advancing American interest and keeping American citizens safe. And when you do that, there are multiple ways to do that. And you know, you have the defense, the diplomacy, and the development. And development is really more of a soft power, right? So hard power is what we traditionally think about with national security. I did a national security degree, and all of, you know, my members in my rural North Carolinian community were like, oh, you're going to go study guns. And I actually study the opposite side of that. I do study national security, but it's the soft power. Yeah, it's like, yeah, kind of. The hard power is what you think about when you think of our missiles and our ships and our, you know, our guns and all of that jazz. And then there's the soft power, and the soft power is trust. The soft power is, you know, the leeway you have. It's a great example is, you know, in your own community, it's a nice thing to do to bring someone sick, you know, a casserole, but also you kind of know that maybe if you're sick next time, they might also bring you a casserole, right? And you live your life in these little exchanges of soft power so that you, you know, have room to negotiate and room to live, and everybody is just a little more, you know, communal. So soft power is all about trust and about not the hard side of things. And I say this because it is an incredibly important thing to do. Because then when it comes time for negotiations, or it comes time for that, you know, like, I guess, harder wing to come in, you have some sense of leeway. So, you know, a really great example is in Vietnam, which, of course, in Vietnam, the U.S., you know, left a ton of really toxic substances, and USAID was working with them, especially at an airbase, to completely remove some of these toxic substances, which is a form of soft power because, A, we're cleaning up our mess in a very big way, but also we're working through on this side of diplomacy where it's like, you know, we're going to do you a solid here. And then maybe if we ever need to negotiate, like, that's there. And that's a very, you know, elementary way of describing it. But when you look at the world today, we, you know, we're in this multipolar world where Russia and China, and you've got all of these poles that are going out, you know, from where you had the Cold War of even, you know, Soviet or America, you do need this sense of strategic thought behind things. So, you know, our missions around the world, when you're looking at placing them in Southeast Asia, and that's really important because not only are we helping, you know, these Southeastern Pacific, you know, countries grow education and work on their economy and combat climate, which, you know, is currently not on the table, which is a devastating mistake. We did a lot of climate adaptation work at USAID. You're also placing yourself in these locations to be able to have a sense of influence. And from a national security perspective, I think that shutting down USAID, and I'm not the only one to say this, and I want to give credit to those who do, but it will be the most egregious national security error in our history, or recent history.
I totally agree with you. And you talk about soft power as trust. How trusted is America right now?
My instinct is not very, our word does not go very far right now, but more importantly, our money and our resources do not go very far right now. One of the big things about shutting down USAID is that contractors that have done work in the field and have already done work are not being paid the money that they are owed. And despite the fact that the judges have come out and said, you have to pay these invoices to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, often to American-owned businesses that have been doing this work, then they're still not paying that money. So not only is our, you know, payment, our dollar not trusted right now, but our word is not trusted. We, you know, said that we were going to provide, you know, these countries with healthcare. But what we're hearing from the field is that there are children in line for tuberculosis vaccines that were told to get out of line. Yeah. You know, we told people that we would be providing them with much needed, like truly much needed between life and death meals. Those are sitting in warehouses rotting. You know, we told Europe and we told Ukraine and we told our allies that we would have their back, in part because they've agreed to have our back. And this week alone, all of those guarantees were just completely pulled away. So our word doesn't mean very much right now. Our money doesn't mean very much right now. Our resources mean very little to others. And you know this, we learned this when we're 5 years old, we, you know, when we're children, that the hardest thing in the world to gain is trust, and it takes a very long time. The easiest thing in the world to lose is trust, and it takes a second. And in just a second, you know, with USAID being gone, but also some of the other things that have happened specifically this week alone, I think our word means very little, and building it back up, gaining someone's trust back, very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question is you know, how these relationships that we've had, the trust that we have, you know, from clandestine operations with, you know, CIA or the in your face stuff, the good stuff with USAID. I mean, that takes generations to build. And how, what does it take to get that back?
That's the question for the ages. I think one of the things is that we do run on this sense of hopefully the world knows that this isn't, you know, exactly what the American people wanted. I mean, we did mandate, you know, President Donald Trump into office, but we did not mandate Elon Musk into office, number one. Right. Number two, we're seeing around the country where even people who voted for Donald Trump are, you know, expressing, you know, displeasure with some of these policies, and they're being told to be quiet. It's very clear that, you know, these conversations are not being had in good faith, nor are they responsive or reflective of the American people. And I say this because we actually had a tack when I was a speechwriter for USAID. And when we were talking about what Russia was doing, we did not say Russia is doing this. You know, we said Putin's doing this, yeah, or Putin's government is doing this, because we understood that what was happening from the government does not reflect the Russian people.
Right.
It is not a democracy. They don't have the ability to mandate those actions. And so one of the things I've been holding on to is, it's only been a month, and I had hope. Again, we have four more years of this, so this answer is very, you know, premature probably, but I would hope that there is this sense of understanding from people around the world that, you know, as much as we have trust, we have a sense of grace, and there's a sense of grace that, you know, the American people are kind of in a bind right now. Yeah. And that if this were to change, now the thing is how much is that going to reflect in the next change of leadership? How much is that going to reflect over the next 4 years? What are we going to be left with? And for those answers, I don't know, because you have a sense where other countries have to protect their own interests too. And right now the United States is kind of like a unpredictable, you know, it's just going here and there, and you can't predict. And one of the worst things for any national security is unpredictability. But to get that trust back, there's already a legacy of having this sense of trust broken. Like when we look, and we have to talk about this, like the, you know, the history of colonialism, the yeah, history of slavery, the history of, you know, extraction across the world. And when we're looking at USAID, development has changed over the years. And, you know, development, as we were trying to do it, at least under the last administration, was inclusive, yeah, diverse, localized, yeah, et cetera. And to then go ask for trust again from communities that have historically not been able to trust, I think that that's a very deep conversation that has to be had across sectors.
Yeah. We're talking with Christina Dry here from USAID. On the other side, we're going to talk about some of the things that she's experienced, both the good and then how did this actually happen? How the heck did this happen here on the Rational Revolution? We'll see you back in a little bit. Welcome back. You got the Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker. We are talking with Christina Dry, speechwriter, communications analyst for USAID. I really appreciate you being here and kind of giving us an insight to what's going on and what happened. And I wanted to talk about, like, what were the things that you experienced at USAID that was like, wow, this is why we do this?
Yeah. Wow, that's such a big question. I'll say I made me cry. I've seen USAID throughout my life. So my background is in studying atrocity and institutional decline, specifically in Eastern Europe. So I lived in Bosnia. You know, I also had a stint in Colombia. So I even saw USAID there before I even started working here. But at USAID, I would say that as a speechwriter, I got to speak to so many people doing research so that we effectively told their stories. And what I would hear from the ground is that, you know, there are thousands, tens of thousands of people around the world for whom USAID's work was not only a means of empowering their own communities and driving change, but also truly the lifeline between one meal and the next, or having a house and not having a house, or, you know, really being able to know that there was healthcare available. There are so many people who got, you know, HIV antiretroviral treatment from USAID, and it's literally the thing that gets you from day to day. Yeah. Like that is how you manage that disease. I remember hearing stories of, you know, a widow in Ukraine whose house had been bombed and USAID was helping her to, you know, rebuild that house and stay in her community. And she had lost some people in her family. And I just remember writing that speech and being like, wow, like this is really changing lives. There's a story in Afghanistan where, you know, right now girls over the age of 12 aren't allowed to go to school. So one of the ways that they can continue to go to school is a midwife school that's hosted by USAID. And it's the only access they have to education past the age of 12 and also helps improve maternal health in that country. And that's now shut down. So these girls are like, not only do we know that our births and our pregnancies are going to be less healthy, the one way we had access to education past, you know, I guess the equivalent of sixth grade is gone. And we don't know what we're going to do.
You said something when we spoke on the phone earlier that stuck with me. And it like hit me like a ton of bricks. And you said that you traveled to different countries around the world that were run by like a dictator and all of that. And you said, I always wondered how that happened. And you said, well, I kind of know now.
You know?
And when you were watching the campaign and everything that was going on, I don't remember this being on the chopping block or on the radar. Did you guys see it coming?
No, my answer to that is not the way that this has happened. Even in Project 2025, when development was mentioned, it was always mentioned about changing the ways that we did it. We also knew within the walls of USAID, we knew that climate change was probably going to be on the chopping block. We knew because it had been very clear that DEIA, diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility were going to be on the chopping block, which for USAID specifically, I know that's become like a very woke thing, but for USAID, we work with marginalized communities. We work with vulnerable communities. These communities usually are communities with people of color, indigenous communities, women. Like USAID is DEIA in many ways, in the ways that we work. So we knew that would hit us really hard. And we were working through how to, you know, communicate those things in new ways and how to reorganize our programs to achieve the same thing. Because, for example, if you have a women's, you know, empowerment program in Central America, maybe saying a women's empowerment program is DEIA, but it's also economic inclusion. So then you just, it's an economic inclusion program. We, in our wildest dreams, did not imagine that this was the outcome. I was in the building those first 12 days, and it was unlike anything I've ever felt before.
What was it like?
It felt like so censored. It felt so frightening. It felt like there were ears in the walls. People would be there one day and then the next day they'd be gone and you didn't know where they had gone. We would literally walk. We would leave and we would walk two or three or four blocks away to get coffee because we did not feel safe communicating in the halls. We knew that our Google Meets were being transcribed early. You know, we'd heard that that was the case. And they even took down pictures from the walls of our work, pictures of like women receiving food and children, you know, playing ball and stuff. They took them down. They unplugged our television so we couldn't watch news. The people in the front office. Okay. So it would have been the new political appointees. And then Doge was in the building the last week. It was really terrifying. I'm, you know, a white woman here and I have never heard the phrase "you're not safe" so many times as I did in those 12 days. And that's me. I know that my colleagues that, you know, maybe are like visibly queer or, you know, people of color felt even, you know, more targeted because that was the very essence, is that there's this sense of censorship. There's a sense of, you know, humiliation. There's a sense of shame. And it felt very antithetical to not only everything we did as USAID, but also to who we are as Americans. And it was very scary.
Talk about that where, you know why this stuff matters and you know why the work is so vitally important. And then for someone to say that this is all, you know, it's a whole thing as a fraud, and to have I call them the Doge brown shirts, but coming in and, you know, my words, not yours, but I mean, talk about that, you know, just the overwhelming sense of like, you have no idea.
Yeah. It felt like a betrayal, in the sense that we are public servants too, and we are serving the American people too. It might look like a different kind of service, but it still is service. And something that I found incredibly unique about USAID is, you know, we're committed to serving the American people across administrations. And there are people at USAID who have worked for, truly decades, like 30, 40 years across administrations to do this work for good. And they're very willing to sit down with any new leadership and say, okay, like, I know that these are your priorities. Here's what we do. Here's how we can merge them together. Here's how we can compromise. Here's how we can still do the work in the field. And it was, they didn't want those conversations. They literally did not talk to us. They did not want to communicate. When people tried to communicate, they were ignored. So there was no good faith effort to, you know, engage, to reform. It was just slash and burn. It was a raised earth strategy. And it's a fairly highly skilled field. I mean, you see these books behind me, and this is just like 1/20th of what people with PhDs that worked at USAID read to be able to do their work effectively. The research we do, the knowledge we have, the institutional knowledge that people who have been there for decades, and all of that was just completely, it was rendered invisible. I mean, it was rendered completely moot. And to think that not only your life's work, but also your life's, you know, commitment to giving, to empathy, means nothing and is not valued. It felt like there's so many other options for people to serve around the world. Like, there is the private sector just sitting there, and these people have chosen to sacrifice their lives and their careers to do this work. And all we want to do is serve the American people. And for someone to look at you, well, not even give you the dignity of looking at you, to say that we don't want you here, we don't want your service, that hurt. I mean, it's a sense of grieving because it feels like there is no place. But what does it mean about our country when you're being told there is no place for empathy?
That's exactly right. What did you have conversations with people at DOGE or people like, what was that like?
Yeah, I had conversations with the new political appointees. I didn't have conversations with DOGE. DOGE, we knew, were in the building, and they were, you know, one coworker would pull you aside and say, DOGE is in the building. Make sure, like, you know,
are they like hiding or something, or how?
There were like 8 of them, and they were all the young children you've seen in the articles, but they were all in the front office, the bros trying, they were up with the tech folks trying to like get all that stuff done. Cause after they were in the building for a few days, that Friday night is when all of our websites went down that Saturday morning. My access was pulled without telling me mid Saturday before the building was completely shut down. So that's what I was talking about when there's a digital go bag for federal employees. I lost all access to my writing samples. I lost all access to my communications. I lost all access to certificates that I'd had for good work. Everything gone, no way to retrieve them without like any information whatsoever. We did not get told that our access was going to go, and then it was just gone. And then with the websites being down, all of our documentation of our programs also gone. So the American Foreign Service Association has actually created what they call a digital go bag. And it's a list of things like get your clearance documents, get your certifications, get your like kudos, like if, you know, Samantha Powell had told me there was a good speech. I don't have that. Get your writing samples so you can apply to new jobs. And there's a list of it. So really, it was just a sense of fear. And then talking to the people in the front office, the new political appointees, and there were 8 of them. I think 2 or 3 of them are not there anymore because they tried to stand up. But they were folks that were like a Tea Party activist from Lynchburg, someone who was a January 6th sympathizer. So there's a list of them that had that kind of background. And when you would communicate with them, it was just this like wall of, I just knew from day one when I met them that there was this sense that a decision had been, I didn't know what that was at the time, but it felt like you couldn't reach them, that there wasn't really a conversation about to happen. And of course, I was never able to write a speech for them because they closed the building and shut down the agency.
So as a federal employee, you're talking about this digital go bag. So that's something that, like, you know, it's like a CYA to like a cover your, you know,
What is that? I mean, it is. So as a federal employee, and to clarify too, because this has gotten some traction online against me, but especially at USA, there are a lot of different hiring categories. So there are people that are directly hired through USAID, and then most of our work is done by contractor, but you're still in the building. You still have a .gov email. You still have an office. It's just basically your pay is through someone else, through USAID. So it's just an extra person. I say this because even people that are contractors who 100% work for USAID, like I did, also need digital go bags. And it is a CYA. It's very much like if that goes away and you weren't told, but you also have to apply for other jobs in a job market that's saturated with like thousands of your fellow employees and best friends, you need the writing samples. You need the confirmation that you have a clearance if you have a clearance. You need the kudos and anything else that you use to get a new job, to function for your own memory's sake too. Like you want to have the communications and the work and also contacts. Like at USAID, we had 10,000 to 14,000 people employed, but we also worked with folks around the world. And when that went down, unless you knew their first and last name and they had an online presence, you'll never get to tell them sorry. None of us have been able to look at people in the field who we served and say, this wasn't our decision. I am sorry. Are you okay? We have not been able to do that unless we happen to have their first name, their last name, or their personal contact information. So that's in the digital go bag too. It's like, if there are people you want to talk to at any point in the rest of your life, get that name and number.
We're talking with Christina Dry here from USAID. And we got a minute left here. You've been a target online. Talk about that a little bit. What a surreal thing.
Yeah,
like some of the most powerful people in the world. Like,
I know, right? Elon and Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think for me, and I'll try to be quick here because I know we're at time, but for me, if I worked at USAID and we were asking people around the world to support independent journalism and share their stories and engage in their democracy to be able to bolster, you know, their democracy, then I think that we have to ask that of ourselves. And I mean, living in Bosnia, I watched that, you know, every single day I was there, and I can't look at these people in the face and say, I asked you to do that, but I can't ask that of myself.
Yeah. It's something that it's really hard to put into words. And then one more question, because I've read articles about this and, you know, cutting all of these programs. Is this even legal? Can he legally do that?
Well, that's what the lawyers are trying to figure out. Well, number one, you can't unilaterally shut down USAID. So that part itself is definitely illegal. You also can't fire certain categories of people the way that he's been doing. So that's illegal. You also can't not pay people for work that's already been done. So when we get to this like contractor situation where our implementing partners have outstanding invoices for work that has already been completed, it is illegal to not pay them for those services. That is definitely illegal. Now, where we get to some of the things the lawyers are like really figuring out is to what level can you shut down certain programs without notice? To what level can you shut down certain categories of employment without notice? We'll see.
Christina Dry from USAID. I would love to have you back and kind of recap what's going on. And I thank you so very much for your work for
the
country.
Thank you for having me.
And your time today. Thank you so much. We'll be right back here on The Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
In the wind, the answer is blowing in the wind.
Welcome back. You got The Rational Revolution. I'm Mark Becker. Wow. That was a remarkable discussion. Christina Dry. Speechwriter and all things guru here for USAID. You know, that was something I was preparing for that discussion, and I didn't know what direction it was going to go. I talked to her before we did the interview a couple weeks ago, just to, you know, make sure that I'm on the level, because, you know, she has been attacked by some of the most powerful people in the world. You know, Elon singled her out numerous times for attacks, and her life has been very difficult over the last month, and but she has the courage of a lioness, and I hope she will be back, because just a remarkable story. And I'd love to talk to her about her time in Bosnia. But that really did stick out when we talked on the phone, where she said, I always thought, I wondered, you know, how did people let this happen? And now she knows. And it's interesting, because, you know, authoritarianism doesn't happen typically through violence and through force. It happens through the ballot box. It happens when people voted in. And we're kind of witnessing that in real time. And it was really interesting to hear her talk about and articulate so much better than I, that's why she's a speechwriter, so much better than we ever could, about why USAID matters, why those programs are ones that are vitally important, you know, not just for the people that they serve, but at the end of the day, they serve the American people. And they serve our interests. And so when things happen like a dust up in Ukraine, or God forbid something happens in the United States, we're going to need those people. We're going to need allies and friends. And what we've been doing over the last month, I can't believe it's only been a month, month and a half. But what we've been doing is just destroying those relationships that have taken generations to cultivate. And the trust, like she said, trust can be broken like that. And everything that we've done over these first few weeks of this administration has been breaking the trust and breaking alliances. There's so much damage that we've seen. And what's crazy is it's hard to really tell, because we're so early into it. It's hard to tell which part of it is going to be the most damaging. You know, is it the trade war? That we've now gone like twice through the trade war. We've announced that we were going to do these tariffs, and then say, oh, we're not going to, and now they're back. There's no end in sight. And the frustrating thing, in a laundry list of frustrating things, is that there's no real plan. Christina said that a little bit in the interview, that there's so much confusion and there's no real end goal. So the American people are looking at all of these things, from the tariffs to dismantling government agencies to all of this, and they're like, what is the end goal here? It's very, very dark, and there's uncertainty across literally every spectrum of our country, you know, from food to national security, to, as Christina said too, to the programs that we have, Medicaid, SNAP, Medicare, all of these things. He promised to work on these things, and here we are with no real plan. And I kind of want to tell you what I think is going to happen. I'm not necessarily in the business of making predictions, but I will make one. If I would put on a very dark hat and I was advising Donald Trump, this is what I would say. And first, you have to sit down and realize that the things that he wants to do are incredibly unpopular. And you will face unprecedented blowback, the likes of which the United States hasn't seen in generations. He wants to fundamentally transform the federal government and how the federal government has worked for hundreds of years. You want to strip people of their rights. You want to seize power like no one has done in the history of the country. You want to eliminate agencies that people depend on. You want to destroy relationships with our friends that have been ironclad since the 1800s. You want to dramatically increase the cost of living through tariffs and give tax breaks to the world. Like, these things are not popular. You have to realize that. However, if you want to do it, there's a way, and we're seeing it. And that way is first, you have to make people hurt. And it is. He is. Make them feel pain, like higher cost of living, higher groceries and gas prices and vehicles and houses. Slow the economy down. Mail delivery. Make them question the federal government. Your services aren't working. Who's at fault? The benefits are slow to arrive. Tax refunds take months if you get them at all. Weather forecasts are spotty. Make it hurt. Drive that wedge as deeply as you can. You're seeing them do it in real time. Tariffs. Make Americans feel them. Watch the stock market free fall. And then what you do is about 6 months before the midterms, just magically raise your wand and fix all the problems you created. Stop the tariffs, lower the taxes, give people stimulus checks. He talked about that. They're going to give a Doge refund and make them feel like it is spring after a long, dark winter and give them hope. But that hope comes from you, not the opponent. And you can do that because we're in an era right now where truth doesn't matter. And you can tell them this is all, they can say it's Joe Biden's fault, it's Kamala Harris's fault, it's the Republican, it's the Democrats' fault, when in reality, it is Donald Trump's fault. And it's the fault of all of the people who enable him. Like right here in Wisconsin, we've got our buddy Ron Johnson and Tony Weed and Derek Van Orden, Brian Stout, those people. Tom Tiffany, Glenn Grothman. It is their fault that this is happening. But if you can switch that narrative and say, look at all of the things that we're doing. Look at all of these gifts I'm giving you. That's how it happens. I do believe that's how he's going to do it. He is going to make it worse before it gets better, because then this is an abusive relationship, guys. I've unfortunately have experience with that. This is how these relationships work. I'm going to hurt you, but I'm also the only one that can fix it. And what we have to do is know that it's coming. You have to know it's coming, because that's the only way we can fight it. Thank y'all. Thanks to Christina Dry from USAID. Thanks to Amanda behind the glass. And to Civic Media. This is Mark Becker on The Rational Revolution. We'll see you next week.
Hey, I'ma keep running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.